Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Kerry Curtis, chair of the club's Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum and your chair for today. We welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Marla Smith-Nielsen. She's speaking on the subject, Moving Beyond Lip Service for Sustainable Water. Marla is the founder and the executive director of Water First International. She brings 20 years of hands-on field experience with community-managed water supply, sanitation, hygiene education, and water source protection projects in developing countries. Marla has overseen the implementation of over 450 community water and sanitation projects in Latin America, Asia, and Africa, benefiting nearly 200,000 people. Marla is a civil engineering graduate of the University of North Carolina and the University of Arizona. Marla is originally from the small southern Arizona town of Benson and now lives in Seattle with her husband, Jim Nielsen, and their children, Calvin and Melina. So without further ado, I give you Marla Smith-Nielsen.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here this evening to talk about the global water and sanitation crisis, an issue that I have spent my entire adult life working on. As Kerry mentioned, Water First is the organization that I'm working with. We're a Seattle-based nonprofit organization, and our mission is to enable the world's poorest people to implement and sustain community-managed projects that integrate a safe water supply, toilets, and hygiene education. Water First works in four countries, India, Bangladesh, Honduras, and Ethiopia, and our projects are implemented through our in-country partners, professional organizations that we have selected for their abilities to work effectively with beneficiary communities. Now, we all know that access to water is a basic human need. Yet in our world, 1 billion people rely on unsafe water holes and rivers, and 2.5 billion people lack access to even a simple toilet. It's difficult to determine the exact numbers as there are no comprehensive surveys available, nor are there universal definitions of the terms access and safe. Regardless, the number of people who lack access to safe drinking water and hygienic toilets is unjustifiably large. And the resulting toll in terms of death and disease can only be classified as a crisis. An overlooked crisis, in fact. The lack of access to water and toilets kills an estimated 2 to 5 million people each year, more than wars or earthquakes, more than malaria, HIV, AIDS, and tuberculosis combined. This trend may be changing, but for now, we seem to be focused on preventable diseases, on vaccine-preventable diseases, or on natural disasters as crises. And meanwhile, in developing countries, hospital visits by patients suffering from a disease caused by lack of access to water or a toilet are 10 times the frequency of the next leading cause, which is why half of the in-country partners that Water First funds were founded by medical doctors. The public health aspects are only the tip of the iceberg for this catastrophe. The water and sanitation crisis is also about hunger, lost sleep, limited access to education, gender inequality, and missed economic opportunities. And I will share some statistics with you that describe in dollars just what the cost burden is for the people who lack water and toilets. But I think that this problem is best described by the real people behind the numbers. One of them is Dilium Araya. Born and raised in Eshele, a village in northern Ethiopia, 30-year-old Dilium was already the mother of six when I met her in 2004. At 5 a.m., Dilium awakens to nurse her infant son, Medine, and make a breakfast of injera, bread, and chickpea soup for her family. Around 6 a.m., Dilliam and her 11-year-old daughter, Asmara, strap empty 5-gallon plastic containers on their backs and begin the walk to collect water. It's a 14-mile journey that takes them 6 hours to complete. Dilliam leaves Medine under the watch of her 7-year-old daughter, Kadame. While Dilliam is gone, Medine misses 2 feedings. Dilliam told me that some days she doesn't have enough breast milk for Medine, and I thought of the calories that she was burning simply collecting water. When we reach the water source, the sight breaks my heart. It's a hole in the middle of a dry riverbed with women lined up, waiting their turn to scoop out, cup by cup, their daily water. Goats and other animals meander nearby. Feces cover the ground. This is not just a water hole for humans, and it's clearly not drinkable water. But there's no other option for this village of 500 people. After filling her container, Asmara bends over deeply to get the 40-pound vessel up on her back, and the ropes visibly are pulling her tiny little shoulders tightly together. For the rest of the day, Dilliam prepares food, makes coffee, and takes care of the family's chickens and goats. She skips lunch herself so that the rest of the family can have more food. And in the afternoon, if there's a time, she will make a second trip to the waterhole. Dilliam is illiterate. After attending a month of school when she was 6 years old, she dropped out in order to help her mother carry water. Dilliam's 2 daughters, Asmara and Kadame, are also illiterate and have never attended school. Dilliam has lost 1 child so far to diarrhea caused by drinking unsafe water. Dilliam is not unique. Every woman I met in Echelet has lost at least 1 child. The month before my visit, Dillian's infant Medine became severely ill with diarrhea. And having already lost 1 child, Dilliam and her husband were determined to save Medine. So they carried him to the nearest health clinic, an 18-mile walk one way on foot. Medine needed to stay in the hospital for a week while an IV drip rehydrated him. The cost of this hospitalization was no more than the cost of a modest dinner for us. But for this family, it meant they had to sell a valuable possession to pay the doctor. They sold their only donkey. In Africa, a family's livelihood depends on a donkey. Dilliam's husband used the donkey to carry heavy rocks in a government road building project. He was happy to be employed, and each week he brought home his salary. He was not paid with money, but with grain to feed his family. And if he had time, he used the donkey to collect water. But that task mainly fell on the back of Dilliam, who even before they sold the donkey was not getting enough to eat. As I sat in their hut and the force of this revelation hit me, I did something I have never done before. I handed them all my cash, the equivalent of about $50 US, and asked them not to tell anyone. I did what anyone with $50 in their pocket would have done, because standing in front of me was an emergency. I didn't think that this family would survive much longer without a donkey. But then I left Dilliam, her family, in the village of Echelet, with the hopes that they were able to purchase another donkey and keep little Medine healthy. But their problem had not been solved. The water was still dirty and far away. At this point, you might be asking yourself, why do people live in environments like this? Why don't they just move somewhere else? In other words, this is an issue of poor selection of a home. In 20 years of working in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, I have yet to find a community that cannot solve their water problem with a reasonable and relatively inexpensive technical solution. What they lack is the money to pay for that technical solution, or the ability to convince the powers that be to invest in their problem. The primary issue for Dilliam and people like her is that they were born poor. Many rich people live in similar or more extreme water supply situations, but they have managed to get society's decision makers to direct resources to their problem. The water supplies for Las Vegas, or my hometown of Tucson, would be two good examples of that in our country. Poor people rarely get that kind of attention in this world. Dilliam's story is not exceptional or extraordinary. It plays out daily in poor communities across the globe. And the costs of this failure, what I would call our greatest failure as civilized people, are staggering. I already mentioned that 2 to 5 million people, mainly children under the age of 5, die each year from water-related illnesses. It's also estimated that the poor of the world spend $80 million each day on the treatment of preventable water-related diseases. That's $30 billion annually. About 100 million children worldwide, mostly girls, receive no education at all, mainly because they're expected to carry water. As many as 1.9 billion school attendance days are lost each year to diarrheal illness. This doesn't include the number of school days lost because girls are kept home from school to help carry water, or the fact that schools and communities without running water cannot attract and retain teaching staff. Between 600 and 900 billion hours of productive time are lost each year in poor countries due to lack of convenient access to safe water and toilets. That's at least 25 times the number of hours worked in a year by the employees of Walmart, the Indian Railway System, McDonald's, UPS, Chrysler, and the armies of the United States, China, India, Russia, and North Korea combined. 10 years ago, world leaders, along with much fanfare and glossy documentation, adopted the Millennium Declaration, promising to spare no effort to free their fellow men, women, and children from the abject and dehumanizing conditions of extreme poverty, launching a new era where all of us in international aid talk about progress towards the Millennium Development Goals, also known as the MDGs, that accompanied the declaration. And buried as the third target for goal number 7, to ensure environmental sustainability, is to reduce by 50% the proportion of the population without sustainable access to safe drinking water and basic sanitation by the year 2015. Access to water and toilets is, without question, a key ingredient to reducing infectious disease, mortality, and morbidity. Although many organizations have tried to directly measure the health outcomes in poor countries that result from access to water, toilets, and improved hygiene, this is an extremely complex and expensive study. A simple internet search tells us what the public health outcomes will likely be. A quick compilation of data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control show that the changes in the United States and Western Europe in the early 20th century are case studies for what can happen today in the developing world. Just over 100 years ago in the United States, child death rates were as high as they are now in much of sub-Saharan Africa. But starting in 1900, death rates fell dramatically in the United States, especially for infants. So what changed? Water treatment technologies, chlorination, and simple sand filtration and sanitary sewers introduced in the early 1900s became the vehicle for a leap forward in human progress. The period from 1900 to 1936 was the era of the most rapid documented decline in mortality in American history. It's no wonder, then, that the readers of the respected British Medical Journal recently voted water and sanitation the greatest medical milestone ever, ranking higher than antibiotics, vaccines, anesthesia, and the discovery of DNA. The evidence is undisputed. Investments in water and sanitation projects have a high return. In fact, World Health Organization economists have calculated that for every dollar invested in water and sanitation in poor countries, $10 is gained on averted health care costs and increased economic productivity. Despite this overwhelming proof of the benefits, we are not going to meet the Millennium Development Goal targets. Based on current trends, the target to reduce by 50% the proportion of people without access to toilets will not be met in Africa until the 23rd century. The president of Liberia, in a New York Times op-ed preceding the MDG summit last September, marking the 10th anniversary of the Millennium Declaration, commented that 10 years is a long time to wait for progress on these goals, but I'm not too young to remember the International Drinking Water Decade, during which we set a goal of safe water and toilets for all by 1990. The poor of the world have waited a lot longer than 10 years for us to get our act together. Perhaps even more shameful than our slow progress in this sector is our failure to respond in a way that yields sustainable results. I'd like to read you a quote now from a U.S. Agency for International Development report. It has become overwhelmingly clear that the main obstacle in the use and maintenance of improved water and sanitation systems is not the quality of technology, but the failure in qualified human resources and in management and organization techniques, including a failure to capture community interest. An appalling 35 to 50% of such systems in developing countries became inoperable 5 years after installation. This quote is from 1981, but unfortunately, I've heard this same quote in 2011. Constructing basic, low-cost water systems may sound simple, but it is not. So during the 1980s, a lot of time and energy was invested in troubleshooting the sector and coming up with approaches that would result in much better outcomes. I think that much of the research was right on target, and the recommendations that followed really form the basis of my approach to this work. The astonishing fact is that the failure rate has not changed over the past 30 years. Ironically, while the sector is well aware of these findings and has adopted new language on websites and in grant proposals, in many ways, it still operates on the same basis it did in the 1970s when it was spitting out all the projects that failed. The changes that have been made are either poorly implemented or insufficient. But due to inadequate follow-up, most organizations are not aware of the status of their own projects. Regardless of how much people like to talk about sustainability in this field, the lack of rigorous monitoring remains one of the main reasons so many water projects fail. Here is another quote from a 1993 U.S. Agency for International Development, Water and Sanitation Lessons Learned document. In many technical assistance projects, follow-up receives low priority. Although all parties are aware intellectually of the need for it, the urgency of other business, new activities to plan and manage, or paperwork to be completed, frequently has more immediacy and receives greater attention. Little time may be left to seek information on past activities, to see if the objectives were really met, to reflect on experience, and to apply lessons learned. In the past 30 years, the sector has had a chance to decide to adopt more sustainable practices or continue on a path of high project failure rates. If project failure rates haven't changed, it seems like the sector has opted for business as usual while paying lip service to sustainability. Many of the op-eds and reports preceding last September's Millennium Summit called on donors and international aid organizations to focus on the success that we have had in meeting the MDG goals. We may have had success in microfinance or developing and distributing vaccines, but I find very little positive in the image of 2.5 billion people having access to medicines while they are surrounded by their own feces for lack of a toilet. And well-meaning can no longer substitute for success. I'm well-meaning too, but I don't want anyone giving me any slack if I don't have good intentions plus results. At a recent conference I attended on sustainability in water and sanitation projects that was hosted by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, I asked another participant from a major U.S. charity why his organization would enter into agreements with donors to do projects that they knew didn't meet the best practice standards that we've been talking about for 30 years. His response, we have to make compromises. Unfortunately, the compromises we make tend to have negative consequences for the Ethiopian water-carrying mother and not us. We still collect our salaries. But if the water project fails, it's the Ethiopian mother who must return to the drudgery of carrying water from distant and contaminated sources. We rationalize that one large charity refusing to participate in this broken system doesn't make much difference. If Charity A doesn't sign the contract, then Charity B will. For more than 30 years, we have tried to make do, letting fundraising priorities trump the priorities of the very people we are organized to help. And as TV's Dr. Phil would say, how's that working for you? Not so well, from what I can see. I think it's time to test out a new approach where we all hold hands and jump in together, sticking to our best practices and not agreeing to strings in funding contracts that prevent us from doing so. So why do these water systems fail? Simply put, they fail because they aren't maintained. So I think the question that we should be asking is why aren't the users equipped to maintain them? Over the past 30 years, the international aid sector has established several principles that underpin the success of water and sanitation projects: appropriate technology, an integrated approach, village-level operations and maintenance, community management, and private sector participation. More recently, I've heard that loan-based projects are more sustainable than grant-based projects, that community development is unscalable, and that sweat equity doesn't work. Sustainability would be so much easier if it was a recipe, but sustainability doesn't work like that. There's more than one winning recipe out there, so in my opinion, it's a waste of time to try and figure out what's in the secret sauce. Trying to write out a recipe for sustainability is maybe a little like trying to write out a recipe for parenting. My 10-year-old son would love it if we let him watch PG-13 movies, but we don't. He recently conducted his own survey at school with really questionable data collection practices. But his results were that 17 out of 17 of his friends can watch PG-13 movies. So he should be able to as well. Still, we don't think that this is a good choice for our son. We also don't think that the families who are letting their fourth graders watch these movies are bad parents whose children are doomed to failure. In fact, we think of all of our friends as really loving parents making choices that work the best for their families. I use this parenting example because we're talking about human beings. And in all the development speak I hear at conferences and read in the literature, what I often feel is missing is the human element. Words like motivation, respect, pride, status, trust, and relationship. The core of being human is a desire to be valuable to others and to be proud of your position in life. With both my children and our project participants, I've seen that valuing these needs has a direct correlation with motivation and happiness. And successful communities are built by individuals who have a sense of purpose and responsibility. If we don't try and understand what motivates people to make a change in their lives or what barriers they face preventing them from making changes, then how are we going to be part of sustainable solutions? Why is it that we continue to produce these strong words without commensurate actions? It seems to me, intentionally or not, we've forgotten about the very people whom we represent, even though we drag out glossy color photos of them at our fundraising events and conferences. Instead, we're focused on sustaining our own organizations and agendas rather than the paradigm shift that is necessary in order to actually solve this problem. One of the people we represent is Dilium, the poor Ethiopian mother who spends 6 hours a day with 50 pounds of water strapped to her back. And here are 6 points that I think Dilium would like us to consider. First, charities need to invest in our own learning. We need to create an environment, both on the funding side and on the implementing side, that allows us to actually demonstrate the sustainability of our projects, which is way more complicated than placing GPS coordinates and a photo of a hand pump on a map. We also need to create an environment where constructive criticism is welcome. Implementing sustainable water and sanitation projects is really hard work, and I think we get a lot more accomplished in a shorter time period if we were all honest about our challenges and how we work through them. Second, I think anyone who has spent time in a developing nation sees immediately that poor people are incredibly resourceful. They conquer problems on a daily basis that we cannot imagine. And therefore, I believe that our work is only effective if we start from a place of true respect for the people we want to assist. Poor people are their own best resource in escaping poverty, and I think we have to be willing to support solutions based on the priorities and perspectives of the poor people themselves, rather than imposing grand theories and plans upon them. Every poor community is rich in the most valuable resource out there, human intelligence and strength of spirit. If you invest in that resource and provide them with an opportunity to accomplish something they see as critical to their own well-being, you are going to be successful. In 1989, when I was a civil engineering undergrad, I read a book called Don't Be Afraid, Gringo. It's the true story of Elvia Alvarado, a courageous and brilliant Honduran woman who becomes an activist in helping other poor Honduran farmers recover their lands in support of the written but not enforced national land reform laws. Elvia's work as an activist began when she was invited to a course for social workers. It was during this time that I believe she first discovers the hope for a better future that she carries within herself. Elvia said, "I was so happy when I got to the class. I'd never been to a class before, and I was eager to learn. They read the roster, so-and-so, present, so-and-so, present. And when they said Elvia Alvarado and I said present, I was so proud. So were the other women." I'm originally from southern Arizona. My parents were school teachers. And with their summers off, we were able to take long vacations, including weeks of camping and fishing in Mexico. It was during those vacations that I saw girls my age carrying water home to their families. It seemed so unfair that I could be born less than 2 hours north and have a completely different life. I learned that civil engineers built water systems, so that's what I decided to study. Then during my junior year in college, I read Elvia's story, and her message of self-reliance spoke loudly to me. Elvia said, and I quote her, "We Hondurans are capable of doing anything if we had the education, but instead of teaching Hondurans, the government brings in these foreign experts with their huge salaries, and we continue to be idiots. We're not going to solve this problem through handouts, because our problem is a social one, and until we change this system, all the charity in the world won't take us out of poverty." For me, as a young engineer, that meant, instead of being the expert myself, I needed to focus on identifying the real experts: local community organizers, local health promoters, and local engineers with the skills to change the mindset of their fellow citizens into believing that they can also have a stake in the society in which they live. So in the early 1990s, I set out to test that hypothesis, and I found some great data in Elvia's own backyard in the state of Limpira, Honduras. Located on the western border with El Salvador, Limpira is the poorest and least developed state in Honduras. Thus, not surprising, access to water and sanitation is a major issue for many people who live there. And nestled in the heart of the forested mountains is a small town called Candelaria. 28 years ago, a group of people from Candelaria resolved to address their water supply issue and came up with a scheme to cap a mountain spring and bring the water to all the households in town. The scheme involved a well-conceived program for community involvement, training, and coordination, and outside financial and technical assistance from an organization called Catholic Relief Services. The project worked, and the people behind it decided to keep it going. The process for community development that they had created was something they could share with their neighbors. So for the past 20 years, the poor people of Limpira have been making slight modifications to that same basic model, and in the process, they've now completed over 250 community-level water projects that are all still functioning today. These are subsistence farmers who live simple lives and have limited opportunities for training and exposure to the best management practices of the sector. Yet they have a project success rate that literally no one can beat, and one that organizations like the U.S. Agency for International Development, that are stacked with highly paid and highly trained talent, can only dream about. The Luce affiliation has become a well-defined, well-run organization called COSEPERDIL, which is now our project partner in Honduras. Elvia was right. It is the COSEPERDILs of the world that will solve the global water crisis. But that's not where the aid community is placing its bets. On our 2010 visit, we learned that although there are still many communities without access to safe water in Limpira, Water First is COSEPERDIL's only remaining funding source. Everyone else has pulled out and is directing funding elsewhere. If we don't keep funding the superstars, is it any surprise that our success rate is hovering around 50%? It is clear to me that our highest and best use as the people with the money is to support a system that unlocks the power that individuals already contain within themselves. Permanent change will not come as long as we think of ourselves as the only ones with good solutions. We have to invest in developing the potential of others. Third, local water supply and sanitation solutions must respect the priorities of the people who will use them. No matter how innovative or cheap the water filter or purification system, it will not carry the water for Dilium. We need to think about her time and her burden. Water collection is a task so backbreaking that it leaves sores on women's backs. They suffer chronic back pain, and I only see men doing it with the help of a donkey. If we really believe in gender equality and the girl effect and that women hold up half the sky, then we need to respect women enough to ask them what their priorities are. And we also need to respect the fact that their priorities may be different from ours. Because for women, frequently water quantity is more important than quality. I have found that men typically have different reasons for participating in water and sanitation projects than women. And people living in rural settings have different motivations than people living in urban settings. When I ask women why they want to participate in a water project, the answer I get is not surprising. They want to end the walk for water. In terms of technology selection, this often means that solutions that only address water quality, such as household water treatment devices, are not typically good options for the very poor, because they don't meet the highest priorities of 50% of the users. It also means that a successful solution involves investments in more expensive infrastructure, such as pipes and pumps and storage reservoirs, that bring safe water closer to the users. Once we understand people's motivations for participating, then we are in a position to design a program that takes advantage of the leverage that is present and includes other activities that might initially be lower priorities for beneficiaries, such as public health education about toilet use and hand washing. And it's not really that hard to figure out what the highest priorities are for the world's poorest, because their values and preferences are actually pretty similar to ours. They want safe, convenient, reliable water supplies and clean private toilets that don't stink. If you don't want to poop in a compostable bag or have your children get their drinking water by sticking one end of a straw into a filthy, feces-contaminated river, sucking it into their mouths and hoping the filter still works, despite the high media coverage these two particular technologies have received, a poor Bangladeshi family probably doesn't want to use them either. All of us working on this issue want to end the suffering, and thus I think it's tempting for compassionate donors and organizations to leap for quick and inexpensive solutions in order to provide the fastest solution to the most people. However, the fourth point I think Dilliam would like us to consider is this. Should we be relying on cost per beneficiary measures to make decisions? I don't think I'd want to live in the community where the type of project implemented was based on the cheapest upfront costs. And if I did, I wonder how motivated I would be to maintain it. Doesn't this create an environment where best practices are sacrificed to faster and cheaper practices that are incomplete or unsustainable? Water First costs vary quite a bit based on the environments where we are working. In the dense urban slums of Dhaka, Bangladesh, the projects implemented by our partner there simply involve hand drilling a well and installing minimal piping to a single public water point. And therefore, our cost per beneficiary is in the neighborhood of $25 per person. In rural Honduras and Ethiopia, it's different. And our costs per beneficiary are anywhere from $50 to $175 per person. Individual households in these rural settings are far apart from each other, so we have to invest significantly in piping to public water points or even household taps to meet our goal of reducing the walk for water to 15 minutes or less. Fifth, our investments also need to be made in people, because this problem can't be solved with a gadget. In our fast-paced world, where philanthropy is increasingly dominated by those who are interested in technology. We seem to be driven by a desire to be the inventors of the silver bullet. But there is no one-size-fits-all solution to this global problem. There is no box that sits on a shelf with a device inside that will convince that Ethiopian mother that her child's diarrhea will stop if her family builds this toilet and they routinely wash their hands. It takes person-to-person education within each village to achieve that most critical piece of the water and sanitation solution. Each community is unique, and thus our investments need to be long-term, patient, and adapted to local conditions. Finally, I think Dilium would like us to concentrate on building local human capacity with focused and committed investments. For too long, we have viewed our work in terms of building a single water or sanitation system rather than providing a service that builds the capacity of participant communities, local organizations, and local governments to manage the ongoing task of providing water and sanitation services. International donors tend to think that success is demonstrated by working in many countries, placing a bunch of dots representing new hand pumps on a Google Earth map. I believe we need to take the opposite approach. With success demonstrated by focus and commitment and creating an environment of constant program improvement. In December, I was in Bangladesh to evaluate the work of DSK, a water first partner that was founded by Bangladeshi professionals in the mid-1980s. We were visiting slums in Chittagong City, Bangladesh's second largest city with a population of 4 million, about a third of whom do not have access to safe water or toilets. One of the slums we visited was called Hajikamp. And over the next 3 years, DSK has plans to help 100% of the families living in Hajikamp construct hygienic toilets and safe water systems. But that won't solve Hajikamp's water and sanitation problems. Hajikamp is built right next to staff and officer housing for the Bangladesh Railroad Authority. These modest brick homes have indoor plumbing, including flush toilets. But unfortunately, the waste from these toilets is not flowing into a sewer system. Instead, it is flowing right through the Hajikamp slum. I'm not new to slum life, but this was truly astonishing to see. The fact that one group of people could knowingly pipe the waste from their toilets into the living space of their immediate neighbors was horrifying. Even more horrifying was the fact that the railroad housing complex was getting a bit of a remodel. On the day of our visit, masons were constructing a brick wall to hide the slum and all that sewage from their view. And although I was quite upset with the level of human rights violation I was witnessing, I thought to myself, thank God for DSK. Thank God these people in Hajikamp have an ally in solving this problem. And DSK does have a plan to fix this problem. In addition to helping the families of Hajikamp construct their own toilets, DSK plans to facilitate a dialogue between the residents of Hajikamp and the Railroad Authority, with the goal of convincing them to fix their sewage piping. What makes me thankful is that I know DSK has experience dialoguing with government entities and getting positive results. They have already negotiated with the railway office to allow slum dwellers to legally connect to the railway's water supply system. They have successfully exempted their projects from the customary practice of charging service fees, also known as bribes, for the approval of new wells or new connections to the city water lines. So we're confident that DSK can team up with the residents of Hajikamp to address a serious water and sanitation-related issue far beyond the scope of any technological device. DSK is in this position because they have received consistent funding from their donors, including Water First, that has allowed them to develop long-term master plans to saturate the regions where they work, invest in learning whether or not their old projects are long-term successes, nurture trusting relationships with communities and local leaders, and retain qualified and experienced staff. Rather than bounce from country to country and grant to grant, international donors need to make success possible for organizations like DSK in Bangladesh and Cosay Perdil in Honduras by providing stable annual funding that allows them to build the local capacity they need to address the water and sanitation crisis in their regions of the world. The outlook of people born into a life of poverty is so complex, and something that I, as a rich person, will never be able to understand. These are people who feel forgotten, who feel left out of decisions affecting their lives. And I believe that one of their coping mechanisms, one of the reasons that they can survive, is that they have stopped letting themselves be vulnerable to hope and expectation, and have instead resigned themselves to the difficulties of their lives. It's no easy task to change this point of view. In communities with well-designed and sustainable water projects, I've seen a complete transformation in how people view themselves, how they visualize their futures, and what they're able to achieve. And the first step is that every single day after a water project is complete, they wake up to a very concrete example of how they were successful. Every time they go to the tap and see water flowing, they are reminded that they solved the biggest problem that faced their community. So there's really nothing that's out of their reach anymore. As I mentioned earlier and Carrie mentioned, I'm a mother. My son Calvin's 10, Melina's 8, and given their ages, a phrase that we commonly hear in our household in response to just about anything we ask them to do is, "That's not fair." I say, "What was that, Melina?" And she rolls her eyes and says, "I know, Mom, I know. At least I have water." The truth is, though, this is something I really struggle with. Every day, my job is about trying to help people who have really been dealt an unfair hand in life. And I struggle with my own decisions about the kind of life I lead. It is simply beyond my comprehension that somehow I have this comfortable existence and the dilemmas of the world must struggle so much. I totally lucked out. I did nothing to deserve this life I have. Nothing. I was born, and from day one had opportunities that the people we serve dream about. So today I'd like to challenge each of us to use our winning ticket in the birth lottery in a way that truly helps the poorest people in the world permanently solve their greatest problem. Each year we recognize World Water Day, World Toilet Day, and World Hand Washing Day. We have runs and concerts complete with celebrities and politicians and corporations seeking corporate social responsibility credit. With our clever videos, websites, and use of social media, we are definitely getting better at raising awareness and visibility of our cause. But the world's poorest don't want visibility at the expense of solutions. Lip service to sustainability may help raise money, but it is not helping the world's poorest meet their basic needs. I believe that donors and international aid organizations alike need to remember who we represent and seek out those solutions that build local capacity and put poor people themselves in a position to solve their own problems. Our goal should be to end the walk for water, to end the spread of disease, to put people on a permanent path out of poverty. In short, our goal is to make our jobs obsolete. Thank you.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that you've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker is Marla Smith-Nilsen, speaking on the topic of moving beyond lip service for sustainable water. Now it's comes time for the audience questions, and I'll lead off to get things to prime the pump, so to speak. You still have to prime the pump with pumps? I don't know. Anyway, so I was wondering if you could give us a tangible kind of a vision of what one of these systems might look like, a simple one in a village like you talked about, and what about it might break down that the local people would be unable or unwilling to solve it?
Okay, I'll give you an example of a simple system that we are supporting in India. So we're working in a region of India in West Bengal. That's on the eastern part of India. And our projects are located about 3 hours south of Calcutta, probably familiar with that city, on a group of isolated islands. So it's pretty important there that we drill very deep in order to reach water that isn't saline. So the projects there involve, again, a hand-drilled well, and they put on top of that well a hand pump. It's manufactured in India. It's called a Mark II hand pump, and it's really easy to operate. So people in this region of India really like this hand pump because it's just fairly easy to operate the pump handle. So the communities there need to be trained to do some routine maintenance on this pump. Routine maintenance means they'll unscrew a cover plate on it, so they need to have tools to do that, to literally unscrew some bolts. They need to have a wrench, and they apply grease on the inside. There's a chain inside that helps operate the pump mechanism. They need to grease that chain. They need to grease those bolts to keep them from rusting. This is a part of India that's close to the ocean, so all metal just wants to rust. So it's important to keep everything greased to prevent that rusting from happening. So if people aren't trained, so that's one thing that can go wrong, is that those things can become rusty and break if people aren't performing that routine maintenance. There's other maintenance that needs to be done. There are seals down in the pump that will need to be replaced occasionally, and that takes a more experienced plumber in order to make those repairs. So what the communities need to do in that case is be routinely collecting funds so that when that time comes, they don't know when that time's going to come. We never get to pick when the stuff breaks in our house, do we? They don't get to pick when their hand pump breaks either. So it's important that they build up a savings, and when that time comes, they can hire a local plumber to come fix it. And because it's a locally manufactured technology, lots of people know how to fix it. So, yeah.
On that subject, I'm Rudy Dundas, and I very much appreciate your presentation tonight. I was just in West Bengal a month ago, and the most serious problem there actually is arsenic. And these deep tube wells that are being dug at least below 50 feet often have toxic levels of arsenic. And there are 13 million people in West Bengal alone, not even to speak of Bangladesh, who have toxic levels of arsenic in their drinking water. So I'm wondering what your organization is doing to address that issue, if you're digging deep tube wells.
Well, for one, I wouldn't call 50 feet deep. So what they're finding, you know, the arsenic, the discovery of arsenic is a relatively recent thing. Yeah, and it's happening. They're finding it in delta areas. It has to do with sedimentation. And they're not finding it, though. They're finding it at 100 feet between 50 and 100 feet. That's the common layer where that's found, and it's not found below that. So what we're doing is drilling way below that. I would call my definition of a deep tube well is 200 feet. It's got to be at least 200 feet. And our wells in Bangladesh and India go from anywhere from 220 feet to 1,000 feet. So we're trying to we're drilling below the arsenic layer. And it's not really that expensive because it's not done with a drill rig. It's done with human power. It's hand augered. So it's not that expensive to go deeper. It's certainly less expensive to go deep, avoid the arsenic layer, than to treat arsenic-tainted water. They've experimented with different ways to remove arsenic from the water, and the conclusion has been so far that those technologies are pretty hard for poor communities to use. They're expensive, they're not super effective, and chlorination doesn't remove arsenic. Yeah. So anyway, we believe that it's go deep, and we test. Arsenic test is very simple to do. We can find out immediately if we've gotten to a safe layer.
So I'm also from a small town, and I couldn't wait to get out of the small town to get somewhere where there were resources. And what I'm wondering about in your rural projects, if you have a town or a village of 500 people and all of a sudden you give them water, this is something that none of the villages around them have. Do you see an influx of people that might threaten to overwhelm the resources that you've developed in that community?
That's a good question. I think that could happen, and one of the reasons that we really like to focus in on one particular region and focus in with a partner that's developed a master plan for that region is that you have a plan for covering everybody in the region that way. So, I mean, literally, when we do one water project, the next year we're doing a water project in the neighboring village, and the next year after that, so that we don't have one isolated water system that then draws in people from every single village surrounding it, overwhelming it. I have seen that happen when you don't have this kind of master planning approach with the consistent funding that it needs to implement it.
Hi. I'm wondering, around water, whenever you talk about water, you talk about politics. Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with, I mean, I guess it's no accident that women are carrying the water. How do you deal with the larger issues that lead to adoption and acceptance of a kind of a centralized clean water system?
You mean how to deal with, well, I think I know what your question is, so let me just see if I answer it. Yeah, I mean, it's no surprise that in a lot of these poor communities, resources haven't been directed at this problem because it's the women carrying the water. So a lot of our partner organizations are really great, and not just ours. I'm sure there are others out there at working with the gender inequality issues and talking with the men and women of communities separately and together. And helping them to see, maybe they haven't seen it. And that's a lot of what I've heard from the men after participating in this kind of gender classes, that they hadn't really thought of it that way. And, you know, they do role-playing exercises and all kinds of things to help sensitize the men to what their wives and daughters are going through. I think ultimately for a lot of the men, it comes down to talking to them about their daughters. They may not see it with their spouses, but they definitely want a better life for their daughters. So I think that that's been a a way that our partner organizations that have been able to communicate with the men about these projects, because it's so important to get them on board. When we talk about building up this operation and maintenance fund, I mean, who is it in the family that makes decisions with the money? It's the men. So they need to believe that this is something that they should give their money to.
Hi, thank you very much for speaking with us this evening. I definitely agree with your opinion on how proper maintenance and appropriate resources devoted toward maintenance of projects is imperative. Approaching the issue from a product design perspective, I'd appreciate your perspective on what are areas where people can still innovate to make an impact. What are areas of product design or product design thinking where someone from that background can still make an impact in developing new technologies? Because I agree that obviously, you know, a gadget could just sit on a shelf if it's not appropriately implemented. But on the same note, I mean, people are constantly thinking about how to reinvent things.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to someone that's keen on trying to make an impact in water from a product design perspective?
I mean, one of the things that I think about needs to be worked on. I mean, there are areas of technology to be worked on, and it's treatment of waste. You know, we in our country, we have a system where, you know, all the waste that we use is piped to one centralized, huge, really expensive treatment plant, and that's how we deal with it. And a lot of developing nations don't have wastewater treatment yet, but they need it. So the discharge from their systems is often in rivers. So I kind of think about what's this going to look like for them? What's the next step going to be for them? Because a lot of people aren't connected to a sewer system. Like, it's not even possible to pipe everything to a centralized treatment plant. So are there inexpensive, more decentralized systems that kind of do the impossible, which is, like, take up zero space, can operate under conditions of, you know, being flooded 1 month of the year, can handle frequent power outages, and still treat waste, maybe not to the level that we treat waste in this country now, but at least lower the impact that they will then have on fresh water sources. So if there are some technical people out there who get really excited about waste treatment, I think there's huge opportunities to build these small, think about what, how would you build this small treatment plant? So, and fit it in a slum in Dhaka, Bangladesh. You know, you could put, if it was little enough, you could have housing on top of it. That's sort of what I picture.
I'd like to remind our listening audience, you're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker is Marla Smith-Nilsen on the subject of sustainable water. And we've reached the point where we have time for just one last question. So, Who will ask our last question?
Are these areas looking at any problem with large-scale agriculture interests moving in and affecting the aquifer levels? We've had that problem in the United States where cotton interests have sucked up all the water out of major aquifers, and it's become very expensive and very hard to find water, and the levels are dropping dramatically.
Mm-hmm. Definitely where it's a huge problem in India, where electricity is cheap or heavily subsidized, and so agricultural practices are extremely inefficient, and people just pump all the water out of the ground that they need. So that's definitely, it's not necessarily affecting the place in India where we work, but it is impacting India. We've also seen problems where we work in Honduras, where not necessarily large-scale agricultural practices are happening, but people are outside companies or the government are coming in trying to cut down trees that are on the watersheds that serve as water sources for the projects that we funded. Luckily, though, because the communities are very organized in Honduras and have this COSEPERDIL entity to help represent them. They've been able to lobby the government and these companies not to cut down the trees. But I'd say, you know, those companies probably just moved on and cut the trees down somewhere else. So, yes, it's a problem. I mean, we need to be thinking about what's the most important use of the water and how can we be more efficient with our water use. I think in this country we need to think about all the stuff that we use and buy because, you know, to make all of our food and to manufacture things, I mean, that takes water. It all takes water. And as a matter of fact, I mean, less than 10% of water use in the world, probably a lot less than 10%, is for domestic use. You're drinking water, the water you need to bathe, cook, wash clothes. That's a tiny percentage of our overall water footprint.
Please join me in thanking Marla Smith-Nilsen for her remarks here. And now this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you are in the know, is adjourned.